So we all know that the concept of bright indirect light is a disaster. It's super confusing. Most people overestimate how much bright indirect light they have, or just light in general they have in their home. And that's why I am so excited to bring back this two-part series on natural light that I did multiple years ago in this Best of Growing Joy series. It's with my dear friend, horticulturist and lighting expert, Leslie Halleck. She's the author of Gardening Under Lights, which is like the go-to book on understanding grow lights and how to grow. But in order to understand grow lights, you need to understand light. And in this conversation, Leslie and I get into the nitty-gritty. We unpack what light actually means for our houseplants and how we can measure it. And there is a download in the show notes of this episode that you can download. It's totally free and it takes you through 3 days of measuring the natural light in your home so that you don't get confused anymore. Because truly, the number one mistake plant parents make is misunderstanding their light and usually overestimating their light. So I'm so excited to be adding these to the Best of Growing Joy series with a beloved repeat guest of the podcast, Leslie Halleck. So without further ado, here she is. Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants. I mean, it's a big moment to crack the code on what the hell bright indirect light actually is.
Yes, that is a conundrum.
So before I just start to like mine your brain for so many questions that I have about what the hell light is and how to actually measure it, I would love to just hear a little bit about your incredible journey to becoming the author of Gardening Under Lights and hear a little bit about all the amazing things you do.
Well, that is a long story. I've been in the horticulture industry for a good 25 years, so I'm going to try to keep this really short as best that I can. I am what I like to call a multi-passioned entrepreneur and professional. So okay. I come from a background of gardeners and artists. I actually spent the first couple of years at university in art school.
Oh, cool.
And but also caught the plant bug. I had many gardening women in my life from childhood who obviously planted a seed in me that that gave me the core interest in plants and gardening. And when I was 18, 19 in college, after a couple of years in art school, I felt like, hey, I've got this art thing down. I'm not sure I need a degree in it. I want to go get a degree in something else that really interests me that I could turn into a profession. I can always do my art. I want to, you know, jump into. So of course, I picked the lucrative path of botany, from art to botany. So I switched my major over to biology and botany and immediately went to the closest local garden center called the Green Fiddler and talked them into giving me a job. So I started working at a garden center and worked through my plant science degree, my undergrad degree. So I had about 4 years of garden center experience and some landscaping experience under my belt by the time I graduated. Spent another year after college doing my landscaping services, and then went back to grad school at Michigan State in the horticulture department there in floriculture. Okay, which is greenhouse production. Okay. So all of my master's degree research was on environmental controls, lighting, temperature, all of that for greenhouse growing of perennials and flowering perennials specifically. So my goal after that was to go work in public gardens research, which I did. I landed at the Dallas Arboretum after finishing up my master's degree. And since then, you know, have done my tour of duty in nonprofit and landscape companies and many years in garden center. And finally, about 6 years ago, I decided I needed to jump ship and be my own boss. That suits my personality much better. It's better for everybody.
I can relate.
And so I've been running my own consultancy for the last 6 years. I do both horticultural consulting and business and marketing consulting specifically for the green industry. So, you know, there's a long sorted history of all of the things I've done in the industry, but it's run the gamut. In terms of writing Gardening Under Lights, I had actually made a promise to myself that I was not going to write gardening books.
Really?
Funny enough. Well, you know, let's just call it not so much a profitable activity necessarily.
Mm. Okay.
You don't necessarily make money, a lot of money off of writing books, right?
And you're not an Oprah's book club.
No. Yeah. I mean, you know, they're garden books, they're plant books, right? So we're not talking about big bucks here. And it's a lot of work. Writing books like this is a lot of work. And I stay really busy, you know, with my business and consulting. So Timber Press, Tom Fisher over at Timber Press approached me and said, hey, do you know anybody that could write about indoor growing and grow lighting specifically, but that could gear it towards the home or home gardening, not an academic publication, but a home grower. And I said, oh, you know, I don't know. Let me think about it for a minute. I'll see if I can get you a name, because, you know, my thing was I was not going to write books.
Right. But you know, everyone in the business, so you'd refer them to someone.
Right, exactly. So mm-hmm. No problem. And I thought about it. And I went, well, you know, I guess I actually have a master's degree in this, and I do this, and I write for, you know, the consumer for a living. So maybe I should do this. And so I said that to him, and he said, yeah, that's kind of where we were trying to get you to. So we had a laugh about that. And then here you go. Gardening Under Lights became a reality. Long story short.
Wow. And it is, I mean, to my knowledge, one of the only like current books that has like up to date information about like how to measure light and kind of the advancements that's happened, right?
Yes. And that was key. I didn't want to write on a topic that, you know, it was already kind of ubiquitous out there in terms of other publications that were mm-hmm. already available. You know, there's some books out there from the 80s, but nothing had been updated.
Right.
There really wasn't anything for the current market, which seemed kind of crazy given the increasing popularity of growing all sorts of things indoors, what I like to call the closet garden coming out of the closet, if you will.
Totally.
You know, and with so many advances in grow lamp technology over the last few years, I looked around and said, wow, there really kind of isn't anything up to date for the home grower that's not specifically a cannabis growing book.
Right.
Right.
Which you do cover in your book.
Sure. There's a little section. It's in the herb section with uh-huh. other herbs, because right. that's what it is. Mm-hmm. No big deal. No. But it's not a cannabis book. This book is for people who, you know, want to do things like grow seeds successfully up to, you know, growing fruiting crops like tomatoes and cucumbers and grow tents in their garage. You know, I run the gamut. I wanted to give people the opportunity to learn how to rebloom their orchids or keep succulents alive inside mm-hmm. in their house, which so many people struggle with.
We can all relate. We can all relate to that struggle.
You know, so my goal was to get a little geeky. Mm-hmm. I dive into some of the science in terms of how plants use it and how to measure it, but it's optional. You can pick and choose what of that information you want to absorb, or you can come back to it later. And then I have all sorts of practical growing information in the book for, you know, crop by crop when you decide
right.
you want to focus
strawberries
on particular
versus
strawberries, yeah. cilantro, orchids, succulents. So my goal was to really make this a mainstream reference guide for home gardeners and plant keepers of all levels of experience and plant interests.
And you have my friends from Soltech Solutions lights in the book with the photos.
Yeah. Well,
I recognized so many of their lights.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that for me, substance and style have to meld. Mm-hmm. So I'm an artist and horticulturist, right? So that goes hand in hand. I love beautiful things and I like my house to look pretty and I collect things that I think are pretty. And I don't want to hang a 250-watt CFL or CMH grow lamp in my living room. They're not exactly attractive.
No.
Right? So when I first started writing this book, which now is going to be like 2.5 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a 2-year process to get a book out for those that aren't familiar with that process with the publisher. When I first started writing the book, of course, the first thing I did was start digging around for every option that was available that was more aesthetically pleasing, which there are hardly any grow lights that are aesthetically pleasing. And the one light I found 2.5 years ago that was on the market was the Aspect LED from Soltec. And I went, oh, this I can actually hang in my living space and not be embarrassed. This is great. And so I actually, contacted them and said, hey, can I get some images? I want to buy one of your lamps and I want to, test it out. And it just ended up, making it into the book because it's a good grow light that doesn't look embarrassing in your living room.
Yeah, I love it. I actually macrame'd the cord of mine to make it look like a little bit, it's like modern meets bohemian.
I need you to do that for me. Can I send you two of mine and pay you to do that?
Sure, 100%. It's like shockingly time consuming, but it was real. I like doing it, so it feels nice. But anyway, so the thing that I love about this conversation we're having is you have just published a book all about lights and artificial light. And what I really want to talk to you about is how to measure the natural light that we have in our houses.
Sure. Well, look, it's trouble that you run into with natural light that's going to lead you to needing to buy my book.
Totally.
Okay. So, and it's finding the balance between using what ambient light you have in your home to grow plants that will tolerate that. And then when you figure out the other plants you want to grow aren't going to thrive, mm-hmm. you step it up to grow lights.
Exactly.
So you kind of have to learn about light in general, whether you're going to grow plants in natural light or you figure out that you're ready to step it up to some grow lighting.
Totally. So I'm just thinking about, I'm just sighing when I think about like the indoor light issues that I have in my apartment. But so I guess first off, and this is going to be just like measuring and understanding natural light 101 for all of us, because I know it's a pain point for me and it's a pain point for a lot of our community. So I guess first off, what I'd love to ask you is how much stronger is outdoor sunlight versus the sun that we're getting in our apartments, even if it's like southern facing exposure, like streaming through the windows, like it's still there's such a drastic difference in that light. Correct.
Oh, sure. I mean, just stepping from inside that southern facing window that you perceive to be very bright out into the sunshine, I mean, can be 10 times the light difference in terms of volume of light.
Right.
Right. Because we always want to think when we're talking about plants, we want to think about the volume of light, not the brightness of light. We want to think about the volume of light. Brightness is relevant to our human eyeballs. Okay. The volume of light particles is what's going to be relevant to your plants. And so that can be an extreme difference. And then you take that from a southern window to a northern window. Sadly, as a horticulturist, I sort of have this horrible situation of being in a horribly dark house with pocket windows that all face north.
Oh, goodness.
So I have no choice but to use grow lights for most of my plant growing activities, even though I have these big picture windows that a less experienced person would look at and say, oh, you could grow so many houseplants in these windows. I actually have to hang my Aspect grow lights in those windows.
Wow.
Over my plants in order to provide enough lights. So sure, in your apartment with unobstructed views and bright windows, there can still be an exponential difference in the volume of light from inside your windows to outside on a sunny day.
Oh my gosh, I have like 500 follow-up questions and comments for what you just said. So first off, when you talk about the volume of light versus how bright the light is, by volume, you mean like how much almost like light saturation is actually hitting the plant's leaves?
Actually mean individual particles of PAR.
Okay.
To get a little bit technical, photosynthetically active radiation. That is light that is emitted within the color spectrum of light that actually stimulates and drives photosynthesis in a plant. Not all light that we see is as useful for photosynthesis as it is bright to our eyeballs. So, and I have a really good analogy to give you that will make it easy. Real quick, do you know what color of light spectrum that the human eye perceives to be the brightest?
Let me think. I think I just read this in your book, but I can't remember. Is it yellow?
It's green.
Oh, it's green. Okay.
So interestingly, green, while used for other biological processes in a plant, is sort of the least efficient color spectrum of light for photosynthesis, but it's the light that we as humans perceive to be the brightest. So you see the conundrum there. Hmm. What you perceive as bright light may be the least useful to your plant in terms of photosynthesis, right? And without the thing you're trying to do with light is to drive photosynthesis. When it comes to thinking about volume versus brightness, a really easy way that I like to think about it in general is that it is to equate the number of light photons hitting your plant or the volume to calories that we as humans consume, okay. Right? So we have to eat a certain number of calories for our basal metabolic rate, like for our bodies to just function, even if we're not doing a bunch. Mm-hmm. The same goes for plants. So there's there's sort of a number of calories, light photons, that they need to absorb on a daily basis mm-hmm. in order for photosynthesis to work properly in that plant. And that varies by species of plant.
Leslie, that just knocked it into my brain in such a beautiful way, because there's so many more outdoors. There's so many more calories available to plants, especially because it's like they're getting sun from like almost 180 degrees. Right. When you think about it, when the sun is streaming through a window, at like only one side of the plant is sometimes even almost getting that bright light, where like there's more, I guess, limited calories indoors.
Yeah, or raindrops. You can think of it like raindrops. So mm-hmm. each photon of light is like a raindrop, right? So if you're standing outside in a rain shower, you're going to get completely soaked in raindrops, right? Mm-hmm. But let's say you've got a plant in a windowsill, you know, with a window open, that the house and the eave and everything is going to block, right? Most of those raindrops. And only some of those raindrops are going to hit the surface of that plant. So that's another way to think about light photons and volume, is sort of like raindrops that are falling. And when you're outside exposed in full view of that rain shower, you're going to absorb many more raindrops than if you're under a covered eave.
Love that.
So does that sort of make it easier to digest?
100%. Okay, that makes it so much more. So we're just kind of setting this whole conversation we're about to have up under the kind of umbrella statement of plants are created to be outdoors. So when we're having, and they're used to that kind of, you know, that kind of diet. Now, yes. I mean, they're conditioned and they adjust, of course, but now we bring them inside and they're now experiencing a very different amount of light than.
Correct.
So even the brightest windowsill, the brightest southern facing windowsill, is still not going to hold a flame up to, for lack of a better, I guess, choice of words, up to actually being outdoors.
Correct. Yeah. And that's okay for some species of plants, because many species of plants did not evolve in situations where they're exposed to full sun conditions, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Which is why, you know, many of our houseplants are foliage tropicals that are traditionally understory forest or rainforest plants that are evolved to run photosynthesis on diffused lower volumes of light, right? Mm-hmm. So there you go.
There you go. So I want to go back to another thing that you mentioned. So anyway, so in the next however many minutes we talk for, we are going to kind of understand what the natural light in our indoor environments are and how to like get a better idea of measuring it, or at least understanding how it varies. So general rules of thumb with understanding light. And the first rule of thumb that I learned shockingly late into my life as a plant lady is the window trick. And of course, this is everybody's apartments are different. Everybody is going to have different building setups. You know, sometimes you have a southern facing window, but you have a huge building in front of you, so you're actually not getting any light in, or you have an overhang. Or so, disclaimer, everybody's internal conditions are different. But what is the rule of thumb with where your windows are facing and how much sun you're getting?
Well, obviously, in the ideal scenario, southern facing windows without any obstructions mm-hmm. are going to provide you the highest volume of light. Okay. And obviously, the more of those windows you have, the more volume of light you're going to have in that room. That's a pretty simple idea to understand. So plants that require higher light levels, sort of that medium to medium higher light, are going to be suitable for those conditions. You might find that in summer, when light levels are even more intense than they are in winter, that some medium to low light level plants might actually burn a little bit in that environment because mm-hmm. they're getting too much light. Some plants like African violets might prefer sort of a moderate light level and can be placed in a window that maybe has some obstruction, right? So it's a southern exposure, but maybe it's not an exposure for the full time that you might normally get in a southern window. Mm-hmm. So there are all of these nuances to what you can keep in your home. Northern facing windows generally are going to be more shaded for more of the day. And because if you've got an eave on the house or the building may be shaded all day long. So you're generally in a north facing window, especially in winter, you're going to get what's mostly going to fall into shade to heavy shade plant category. So if you think about it,
like a nice fern.
Yeah, exactly. Like ferns are going to be good for your northern windows where you're not necessarily going to get direct hot rays of sun coming through the window like you will in a southern exposed window that has no obstructions. Mm-hmm. So if you've got your bird nest fern sitting in a southern window with no obstructions and it's 3 p.m. in the afternoon and that sun is coming right through that glass onto that fern, chances are you're going to have some scorched areas on those leaves.
Right.
That plant would be happier in a bright, diffuse north-facing window where it gets exposure to light without direct hot rays of sun, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
Whereas a succulent or cactus obviously needs higher light volume. So they're going to be happier in a bright southern facing window. They're not going to be happy in a north window.
No. And then so north is the most ideal for bright. And then second is west, correct?
Well, west is a bit of a toss up because if you've got a western exposure, that means the plant is sitting in, you know, pretty much low light conditions or whatever you have ambient in that room for a good half of the day. And then the sun comes over and it gets blasted with hot afternoon sun. So it has to be a plant that can tolerate medium to higher light conditions if you go in a west-facing window, okay? Mm-hmm. If you go in an east-facing window, then you're in that medium light to medium low light because morning sun is less intense than afternoon sun. So that morning sun is good for plants that are in that moderate light range.
Okay.
Moderate. So it's kind of like if you've ever gardened outside, if any of your listeners have gardened outside, you're very used to annuals and perennials falling into a shade, part shade, full sun category, right?
Yeah.
So you apply those same rules to your north, south, east, west facing windows.
So south is going to be the strongest in terms of where the sun's coming at. Then
it's going to be the strongest in terms of hours of light
exposure. Hours of light.
Right. So it's an accumulation of volume.
Okay.
Right. And which is just as important as your exposure.
So west and east, they might kind of be getting the same amount of time that the sun is streaming in. However, because it rises in the east, it's not going to be as strong as when it sets in the west.
Right. By the time things heat up more in the afternoon and you're going to have a higher sun angle, you've got a more intense delivery of light kind of all at once, you know, in that afternoon. So it needs to be a plant that can tolerate those higher light conditions. If you put it on the west side, plants that are good with morning sun, afternoon shade are going to be good on your eastern exposure.
Okay. And then north is you better stick to low light and say a prayer.
low diffuse light all day long.
Yeah.
Right. Low diffuse light all day long. Mm-hmm. And your southern window is going to be a brighter light for your longest period of time, which that's why most of the time southern windows are recommended because it's a more even, brighter delivery of light for more hours a day than a western exposure.
Right. And you have a better chance. I mean, if it's a cloudy day for half the day or if it rains in the middle of the day, I feel like you have a better chance of at least getting some sort of good quality light at some point of the day. You know, if you have a western facing window and it rains in the afternoon or it's cloudy in the afternoon, that's going to look very differently because you only have that smaller time frame to kind of get that light.
Yeah, it's going to end up feeling like an eastern exposure or northern mm-hmm. exposure window in terms of light volume.
Right. Okay, cool.
That makes sense.
Totally. Okay. So now we understand with our windowsills what light is actually going on. I think for me personally, the biggest issue that I've had as a plant parent is really understanding what happens a foot after my windowsill? So this like mystical, everybody, I mean, I so many plants, people are like, bright indirect light is the perfect option for this. And I'm like, what is that?
What does that even mean?
Yeah, like bright indirect light, like, bright, I don't know.
Look, but here's the conundrum. Okay, as a professional in the industry who has sold many people many plants and who has taught for 25 years people how to care for plants.
Yeah.
The reality is that there are so many organic factors we can't control or plan for in your home or your garden that all we can do is give you a baseline general recommendation for that. Because, for example, my northern windows aren't just northern windows. They're pocket windows.
Right.
Okay. That means they're inset. So the walls of my home, right, come out a good 2 feet from that window. What does that mean? That means that those walls are blocking out even more of that light from diffusing into my room. So right. I get this little concentrated spotlight of light just in the windowsill. If you move back a foot or two from that, it's a whole different ballgame. So, you know, it's really difficult to give plant consumers very specific light instructions that are going to be meaningful. Now, if you're in the industry, okay, and you understand PAR light measurements and micromoles per meter per second and moles per meter squared per day, we can talk that jargon and provide very specific ranges for light volume for different things. But that's not realistic for the gardener,
that's not
right?
What we're doing, yeah.
Right. So, you know, you go with basic guidelines. I think a really easy way to look at it, bright diffuse light is sort of meaningless for most people. I think that an easier way to look at it is the way we just described it. Is this a full shade plant? Is this a part sun, part shade plant? Is it a full sun plant?
Okay.
Okay. And then you follow the basic generalities that we just discussed about your window exposure. And then you take into account any other barriers to light you have, like you said, a building in front of your building or inset windows or whatever it is, big awnings that block out a lot of light. And then you work backwards from that. I think that's an easier way to do it. I can kill ZZ plants and Sansevieria in my house all day long. I've killed a bunch of them. Because darkness in my house is darkness.
Right. That's amazing. Because that's definitely, those are my two go-to low light recommendations too.
Anybody that says to you, you can put those two plants in the darkest corner of your home, that's baloney. Because my dark corner is a whole different ballgame from your dark corner. So you have to work with the space you have. And it takes a little time to develop a relationship with each plant species and figure out what you can and can't grow in ambient lighting in that space.
So let's take my southern facing windows, for example. So in the windowsills, we know, I mean, and we'll get to this later, but you and I have taken some light measurements. Like we know that it's great bright light in the windowsill. So how many feet back from that windowsill that is southern, you know, no beautiful exposure, no buildings around me, how many feet back are we now talking medium light instead of bright light? Do you know what I mean? Like, where does that differentiation happen?
First, there's going to be caveats like, are there windows on the other sides of that room besides just the southern exposure? Or do you only have windows on the southern side?
Oh, no, my apartment, all of our windows are on one side of the apartment, and then it's a very deep apartment. So something that I've learned is I actually have hugely low light spots in my apartment when I thought that I just had a bright, sunny apartment the whole time.
That light degradation or diffusion happens very quickly in a very small amount of space. So if you're lucky enough to live in one of those very well-styled stage spaces that you see plastered all over Instagram and the internet these days, that are completely full of plants because there's windows on every side of the room, practically three sides of the room, then you scored. Most of us are not in that situation. So let's take a room that only has windows, even though you've got a number of windows on your southern side, you've got a light tunnel, right?
Yes.
So the brightest light you're going to have is right in that first, you know, 6 inches of your windowsill.
6 inches. Okay.
Yeah, that's about a ballpark, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, technically every inch, every centimeter is a difference, but that's getting to a micro level that we don't need to worry about.
Okay.
Right. But every little bit that you move back, you're going to lose the number of raindrops of light photons that's hitting your plant is going to get less and less dense. So the density of light, okay, is going to decrease every few inches that you move away from that light. So your plant that's sitting right in the windowsill of that southern exposure is getting the brightest light you can have to offer. If you move a foot away, that plant's going to get less light. If you move 2 feet away, exponentially less light, 3 feet away, right? So by the time you've probably moved, I would say, you know, about 5 feet away from that window, you're moving into medium light territory.
Okay.
Okay. 5 to 6 feet. Once you get to sort of like the middle of the room, essentially.
And medium light could also kind of be interspersed with bright indirect light. Right.
Sure. Okay. Yes. And it also, yeah, again, on a southern side, you're going to get the most hours of you possibly can. Mm-hmm. But if that's a, say, an eastern or western or northern exposure, then you've changed the ballgame altogether. Right. So once you go to that, the coffee table, right, that's sitting in the middle of the room, you know, six or right. so feet away from that table, the echeveria is not going to be as
no.
happy any unless you've got a light in that room hanging over it that's on a good portion of the day. So, you know, it might be happy it right in that southern windowsill. Once you get to that coffee table in the middle of the room, you're losing a lot of light volume.
Yeah, I actually, this is funny because the way my apartment, I love that you call it a light tunnel because that's that's exactly what it is. It's just a tunnel of light that comes down. And the way my apartment is formatted is it's the living room first that has the coffee table that's
there
just
you go.
A few feet away. So I'm like, oh, great. And I'm looking at the succulent. I mean, when I had first started out, I bought a beautiful succulent arrangement at Whole Foods and I put it there.
And
one of the succulents etiolated or stretched to grow to the sun. And I was like, oh my God, I'm such a good plant parent. My plant is growing so fast. It's going so well.
I'm so glad I wasn't there to crush your dreams.
Oh gosh, I know. Then I figured out what happened. But I've actually left it because I think it looks really quirky and funny. And I've moved it closer to the light now that I understand. But interestingly enough, my fluted jade that's also in the succulent arrangement is killing it. Like it looks totally normal, but it was very interesting.
Well, jades will tolerate a moderate light level. Right. They'll actually tolerate a lower light level than other succulents.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So that was a very interesting learning experience from my behalf. And then also a few feet behind that, I have my Monstera cutting and my Raphidophora or Raphidophora, who knows how you pronounce it, but Tetrasperma, another climbing plant that's used to being kind of on the bottom of the rainforest.
Yes.
Those are putting out new leaves, but in a good way, not in a stretching for the sun way, gangbusters.
That's probably actually a perfect medium to medium low light level spot for them.
Right.
Actually. Yeah.
And then, but then what I started doing is then 4 feet behind that. So like a good 12 to 16 feet from my window, which is my kitchen. I was like, oh yeah, this is good. This is bright. This is light. And I would kind of circulate different plants on the corner of my kitchen counter. And I've realized through our work together, or my homework, is that there's almost no light, no natural light in my kitchen.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you get down to, like, if you go to page 46 in my book, you know, I've got some designations of sort of what equals high light to low light. And that's going to fall probably in that heavy shade light volume category. So you're really going to be limited down to just a handful of plants. So, you know, your ZZ plant or your Sansevieria can stick it out there.
Yeah.
But realize that they may not stick it out forever.
Right. It might just be a slow death, a slow burn.
Yeah. And it always is with Sansevieria and ZZ because, you know, they're so tough. And, you know, I treat them as plants that I have to change out in those those really low light spots. So they're just not permanent, or you have to rotate them.
The thing that comes
back to the highlight.
The thing that makes me sad about Sansevieria. Sansevieria is one of my favorite plants. I have a ton of them in my apartment, and they're my favorite plant to gift someone because I feel like if I don't know your apartment light conditions, a Sansevieria is going to thrive in high light or low light. But the thing
that's
that
very considerate of you.
Yeah.
Actually.
But the thing that kills me about Sansevieria is I feel like it's known as the low light tolerant plant, but it actually is a high light plant that's just tolerable. Like it just tolerates low light. And I just feel for the Sansevieria where I'm like, I feel like it never really gets to be in the windowsill because it can tolerate not being in the windowsill. So it doesn't, you know, and like the flower isn't particularly remarkable. So no one's trying to like make it bloom.
Right.
And this is just a little thing that I feel that I felt like I needed to share with you.
look, if you like to your comment at the beginning of the conversation, essentially we're abusing all of these plants already by bringing them indoors, right? Mm-hmm. So we are just subjecting the toughest specimens to the worst abuse, yeah. which is to relegate the Sansevieria to the darkest corners of our home, which, you know, they will tolerate. I can tell you, so the Sansevierias, and I do this because I've got such low light areas, I will put Sansevierias in these dark areas. And I know that I've got about a year of them sustaining, and then they're going to start crashing. And what's interesting is that you think, oh, okay, well, I'm going to water them now because I haven't watered them in a long time because they're such in a low light environment that they can't use a lot of water, right? Or you'll rot mm-hmm. them. And boy, they will crash and go to mush so fast just yeah. with one watering. And the reason is because the photosynthesis rate is so low that the plant can't use that water
right.
fast enough because photosynthesis is so low that they just go to mush. And that's what happens with most of your succulents that you bring inside into low light areas and then you water it. And the succulent's like, look, I can't even, I'm not getting enough calories to right. just, yeah, you watering me now. It's like, I can't take it up and I can't use it. So now you've suffocated my roots and I've rotted and gone to mush.
That's interesting you say that because I definitely thought that it was that the water doesn't have time to kind of evaporate. Because at least if it's in a, if you overwater a plant in a southern facing window, now that I'm thinking about it, doesn't make any sense. But this is definitely what I thought, that like the plant would use up the water, but then also if there's sunlight present, the extra water might be able to evaporate a little bit faster. And then—
Well, the goal of you putting water on a plant is not for it to evaporate, it's to be absorbed.
Of course, right.
By
right.
the plant root tissue, right? But if photosynthesis and water and nutrient uptake are intrinsically intertwined. Mm-hmm. The rate of one another drives the other, and it's all dependent on the amount of light that plant does or doesn't get. So when photosynthesis slows down, so does the plant's capacity to use that water you give it.
Yeah.
So if you're overwatering, and this is a big reason why overwatering is generally the biggest killer of houseplants because
one killer.
But it's not just because it's too much water. It's because it's too much water in low light conditions. So if there were brighter light conditions, there might be a little less overwatering.
Because the plant would be using it. It has nothing to do with the evaporation of the water, Maria.
Right. Exactly.
I'm still learning. I'm still blooming and growing over here. But
People like me write books.
Exactly.
So we can all learn.
Exactly. And why you're generous enough to come on this podcast. Okay. So you're just dropping truth bombs and knowledge bombs left and right over here.
How I roll, baby.
I love it. So here's I love it. I'm so thankful to you. Okay, so here's another question. So I've noticed in my southern facing window, yesterday was a very overcast day. And I felt like as the sun moves, different areas of my apartment get these like very bright beams of sun and they travel through my apartment. And I noticed that the beams of sun will go like 6 feet deep into my apartment and they'll catch those
before they diffuse. Yeah.
Right. Those like quote unquote medium light plants. So is that a moment like, is that another way of kind of judging rule of thumb in terms of your light? If you're seeing these, because that is technically direct sunlight that's getting
correct.
Put on these plants 6 feet away, but the light is very fleeting as it's constantly moving. I mean, maybe the plant gets it for like 45 minutes.
So that's like a quick rain shower.
Okay.
Right. If you think about it again, in terms of volumes of units of mm-hmm. photons of light and the accumulation of those calories, if you will, over a 24-hour period. So those beams of light that are hitting that plant, the plant's getting to absorb some extra photons of light during that period. So that's a good thing for you. That's probably why some of the plants that are set further back into the middle right. of your room are doing okay, because they're in a southern exposure, which means there is going to be some direct more intense sunlight coming through that window. And in that beam of light, you know, the density of light photons is denser. There are more little particles of light.
Right.
And so it's really all about accumulation of volume of mm-hmm. light over that 24-hour period. So that little burst of sun that's coming through is like an afternoon rain shower. More raindrops of light are going to fall on that plant. So it's an extra boost.
It's an extra boost. That doesn't sustain the plant. That's just like an extra little kind of boost, because today the sun was super strong and those beams were huge. But yesterday there were no beams whatsoever because it was a very overcast day. So that's not like I can count on that.
Right. You can't count on that. I mean, what you have to do is balance your climate, where you live, your latitude, your day length. okay, mm-hmm. the number of hours of day length with the exposure of your windows. And that's what makes it complicated. And that's why there's no set formula that you can give somebody to go home with as to exactly where to place a plant in their home, because right. there are too many organic variables to manage. So you have to experiment and play with. And one thing I like to do, and we'll get into more technical ways to measure light later. I assume you're going to ask me some questions about that.
Oh, yeah.
But barring that, bar is zero equipment. You've got a handful of plants. The way I like to test out each individual spot is to group together several plants of varying light requirements, high light, medium light, low light, and grow them in that windowsill for a month or so and see what happens.
And see who thrives.
Who thrives and who doesn't. That's a really easy way for you to figure out what you can grow in that window and what you can't, and what could do with a lower light situation and what might really have to have a grow light in order to survive. And remembering that your summer light levels are going to be much denser and brighter than your winter light levels. And the number of hours of light that you get is significantly less in the winter than it is in the summer.
I just love that you say that, because I feel like, especially in the houseplant world, you get a plant, it says medium light, you put it in the spot, and then you're like, great, done. But I do think that all of this, like experimenting with having tropical plants indoors, it's all an experiment. And I know that, like, I've moved almost all the plants, wherever they are in my apartment right now, is not where they started off. Like, I've had to definitely right. trial and error, especially with the how vague, quote unquote, bright indirect light is.
Right.
You have right. to really figure out, like, okay, but what version of bright indirect light is really the sweet spot for this plant? And it's okay to move them around. And, oh, I stuck it too far away from the light and it, you know, is really sad, so I'll move it. It's not like, oh, you're the worst plant parent ever, you didn't figure that out. Like, I feel like all of this is just, there's a learning curve. And I know personally too, like, I'll cycle things in and out of, I have three grow lights in my apartment. I have too many plants for those three grow lights. So sometimes I'll cycle yeah. plants through, you know, who's-
I do that all the time.
Yeah, like who's in
my
the grow
plants,
house.
Yeah, the thing about gardening is that it's a verb. Nothing about growing is a verb. Plant keeping is not a static activity. Plants yeah. are not static. They're not-
Even if they look static on Instagram.
Right. They are home decor. They are not home decor. They are home decor, right. but they are living, and they are, you know, they're not a set it and forget it. And they're not meant to be set in the corner and never interacted with again. That's not how growing plants works. Mm-hmm. Growing plants is an interactive activity. You know, it's like nature's video game. I think, you know, you have to,
I love that.
Yeah, you have to participate, and you are the determining factor in your success. It's not up to the plant, it's up to you. And I move plants around all the time. Again, I'm in a very low light house. So I create little plant vignettes that change all the time because I have so few spots in my house where I can sustain houseplants without grow light. And I'm constantly propagating new plants. I'm constantly, as a plant addict, I consume far more plants than I ever have room for. I mean, I'm a huge, obviously, outdoor gardener, in addition to being a huge indoor gardener. And, you know, I don't buy plants because I have a space to put them. That's folly. I buy plants because I want that plant, and I'll figure the rest out later. Mm-hmm. I'll figure out where it goes later. And so
you have the knowledge to make it work. You have the knowledge to understand what the plant is.
Yes. Yeah. I have a professional and experiential advantage. However, let me say to you that as a professional horticulturist, I have killed far more plants than you ever will in your lifetime. You will never catch up to me because I grow so many, and I experiment and I figure out what works, and I'm horribly abusive of my house plants and my office plants, you know, because I get so focused on what I'm doing. Plants have to be really tough for me. So they're always getting moved around, and you're always experimenting, and plants are not permanent. Okay. Some plants are going to die. Some plants are not going to work in your space. And I officially absolve you of any green guilt
that
may have of doing that, because again, the professionals are going to kill way more than you. And you learn how to grow something successfully by killing it once or twice.
I see. Yeah, I say that all the time too. Yes. But I love plants are not permanent, because also, if you think about it, they're also just like never permanent in the way that you buy them. Like, they're growing, changing, living things, and they're never going to look the way that you looked when you bought them.
I mean, you don't buy a puppy and expect it to never change. Yeah. There's really, you know, plants are lower maintenance than puppies, but they are living things nonetheless. And so you do, you know, you can read that tag. And this is true with outdoor garden plants as well. You know, I'm in Dallas, Texas. So, mm-hmm. you know, my son's situation here is much different. You're in New York.
Yeah.
Is much different than yours. You know, yes. So we have a whole different situation here and climate and sun intensity and all sorts of things. And most of the industry that writes the plant tags for plants that you buy is very northern centric. And most of what you find on plant tags has no relevance here in Texas in my gardening climate.
Right.
None. Completely wrong. So you take the plant tag information with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
And understand that regardless of what it says on that tag, you have to figure out what that plant does in your particular individual environment. And then it's your job to make it work or to move it or to not grow that plant anymore.
And that's I feel like it is literally half intuition, half education.
Like an experience.
It has
a lot to do with it. It really is, you know, it takes a long time to learn how to grow specific crops and plants. It takes years of experiencing for you to be able to, you know, have that intuition about what's going to work and what's not going to work. You know, I have that intuition about a lot of things and I can predict a lot of outcomes for you. It might take you a few years to figure out.
Totally. I mean, even just thinking my 1 year anniversary of like not killing all my plants was this summer.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm so very proud. But you know, in that 1 year, there's four seasons in 1 year. So like I was constantly learning. Like that 1 year, I just kind of made all my errors in each season. And now in the second year, I'm going and knowing a little bit more. But like it is, you really do need a lot of time because these plants go through all of these seasons and they're affected by them.
Well, sure. It's hands-on experience. And then, I mean, shoot, I spent 8 years in higher education and getting degrees in this. You know, horticulture is a science. You know, gardening is a hobby. Horticulture is a science. There are so many levels of layers of information to learn, you know, and learning to garden and grow plants takes years and years of hands-on experience. So if you don't want to mess with it, you can buy artificial plants. And I as a horticulturist, am not going to shame you for that because I have some too, mm-hmm. due to the darkness of my home. But if you want to grow living plants, you're going to have to just play around with, you know, where they will work, where they won't, and accept the fact that you're going to buy this particular species of plant and you're going to try it where you intend to grow it. And fully understand that it may or may not work for you. And that's okay.
I hope this episode shifted the way you think about light. Just wait until next week. Part two is coming and we're getting hands-on. We're measuring. We're having aha moments. Next week, we'll get more into it, but you can always grab that free Understanding Natural Light download on my website. It brings you through 3 days of measuring your light with a free app to get a better sense of what your natural light is. In the meantime, go take a peek of your windows. Notice how the light moves through your space and don't be afraid to experiment. You're learning, you're growing, and I'm so proud of you. So until next week, keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.